Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
All right, welcome back to Unpacking Peanuts. I'm Jimmy Gownley. I'm here with Michael Cohen.
Hello there.
And Harold Buchholz.
Hi.
All right, so now, guys, what we're going to do is we're going to get into the weeds here. We're going to go through the year, 1951, and we are going to pull out some of what we think are the most noteworthy strips, and we're going to talk about them in depth. Michael, what was your criteria for the strips you picked?
I was looking for a mix of things. One is plain funny. In relationship to where it was at. In other words, better than the average strip. Also, any firsts, you know, the first time a character is introduced, first time some ongoing shtick is introduced. And then I was looking for strips that really, really pointed ahead and evolved the strip, and using the characters and developing the character traits that really become the main focus of the strip. That's sort of what I was looking for.
Harold, how about you?
Yeah, I tried to pull about five out that I particularly just liked or thought, you know, could be considered among the best of the year. And then if I had a note or something I thought would be worthy of bringing up, I would just set those aside as well for some of the same reasons Michael had. But yeah, just kind of, is this new? Is this a hint of what's to come? Those sorts of things.
All right. Well, that's great. Listen, why don't we just get right to it then? And we'll start going strip by strip on Unpacking Peanuts. All right, here we go. January 19th. Charlie Brown is in the foreground. He's crying. Patty and Shermie look on concerned. Shermie says, Charlie Brown's been crying all day. In panel two, Patty says, maybe he's maladjusted. Shermie says, do you think it could be his environment? Panel 3, Patty says, maybe he's frustrated or inhibited. Shermie walks away. I'll ask him. Shermie returns. His shoes are too tight. Very cute strip. Very funny joke. I think it talks about that sophistication, but it's also sort of taking a shot at it as well, which I think Schulz manages to do throughout the strip, to be an intellectual and also take shots at intellectuals.
Yeah, this is the language here is not little kids. I mean, this is the language of psychology when you're talking about someone frustrated or inhibited. It's funny because Charlie Brown, who grows to be the same height and age as the others, is still kind of the baby here. So you see him crying, which is not something you'd see. You know, he's unhappy, but he's certainly not sitting on the floor crying. So, yeah, it sort of emphasizes him as the little kid here, and they're the two older kids. And then it's a funny joke, and that's why I picked it. I think it doesn't say anything too deep, except it does show you this is not a bunch of kids. This is something else.
Yeah. Yeah, that is pretty sophisticated writing for something like this. That would have been pretty unexpected, I would think, on the newspaper page.
Yeah, and it hits it. I mean, as soon as you see the two of them in panel two looking at each other, you know, using maladjusted and environment, it just feels like Peanuts. You know, yeah, the drawing is off model from what we think of as the classic look, but that is exactly the tone that I always think of as Peanuts. And one of the things I find odd about it is when he's doing the cutesier, this is what little kids do type thing, they come off as less authentic kids than when they're doing things that and speaking in ways that kids can't possibly speak, because there is some sort of deeper truth to it that he's at, like when he has them, you know, running around or Charlie Brown's suit's shrinking because it's raining and stuff like that. That all feels forced. And this feels like he's found his voice.
Almost like the characters are underplaying their intelligence. Is that visible in the future?
Yeah. January 23rd. Charlie Brown is sitting at a table writing in a book. Snoopy is very interested in watching Charlie Brown. Panel 2, Charlie Brown says, "I'm glad that dogs can't read." In panel 3, Charlie Brown goes back to writing. He says, "A diary is a very personal thing." Snoopy continues to look on, interested. In panel 4, Snoopy walks away, a smile on his face.
This one is just so darn cute. I mean, in terms of maximum Snoopy cuteness, you get all 4 panels. 3 of them are basically almost the same image, although it looks like Snoopy is getting just a little bit more into it each panel based on where his head is. But it's just the little dot eye and that little black nose and a profile. And just the idea that Snoopy is more than we maybe think Snoopy is here, because we don't know if Snoopy is smiling because he could read. But it's certainly a fun idea to see him walking with this little amused look on his self-satisfied look on his face. It's just a adorably drawn, and it all again is kind of suggesting things about the world of these characters. It's a little bit richer than you might have expected.
Yeah, that's why I mostly picked it, because it is the first indication that Snoopy is more than a dog. And it's not the fact that he can read, it's the fact that he can read upside down. Any dog can read. I mean, but geez.
That's right. That's true. Yeah, I love it. I think it's great. I think that look on Snoopy's face, the knowing smile in panel 4 is hilarious and just as cute as can be. January 26th. Patty and Charlie Brown are walking. Charlie Brown says, "I dreamed about you last night." Patty looks happy. She says, "Did you, Charlie Brown? Was it a nice dream?" They're sitting on the curb. Charlie Brown says, "I'm not sure. I slept through most of it."
You know, I think we can't ignore the fact that Schultz has a little kid in the house. Because this, I mean, it's a great joke, but it's something a kid could actually conceivably say, trying to be funny.
Or not trying to be funny.
Yeah, just or by it. Either way. Do you know what how old Joyce's kid was?
I don't think Meredith is even a year at this point. I mean, she
yeah.
okay.
very young when they get married and get back. I'm not sure what the whole story behind that was, but obviously it was a quick move to become a father of, I believe, an under 1 year old.
Yeah, she was too young to be saying that type of thing. And you know, this is like a Yogi Berra thing or a Ringo Starr, you know, malapropism. I don't remember my dream. I slept through most of it. It's a good joke. It's a really good joke.
I think what makes this a unique 1951 version of this joke is the final panel. Charlie Brown is being a smart aleck. He's got a big, open, wide, happy mouth that he's thought of this joke, and Patty is not amused. I think I could see a later strip when one of the characters, I could see like Marcy saying it, and it's all deadpan. It's not
yes, very much.
Who's saying the funny thing is aware it's a funny thing.
I think the deadpan stuff does work much better because it feels less like this is like a vaudeville thing, you know, where he's indicating this is the joke and you should laugh with his smile.
This is one case where I give it to Charlie Brown. I'd say this is that was a funny joke. It's totally worth it to enjoy the fact that you told a funny gag, Charlie Brown.
January 27th. Charlie Brown and Patty are in someone's living room, and Charlie Brown is kneeling in front of a lounge chair. He says, "I lost a penny underneath this chair." Patty is now peering underneath the chair. Charlie Brown says, "If I had my flashlight, I could see it." Patty says, "Why don't you get your flashlight?" Charlie Brown answers, "It's in the attic." Panel 4, Charlie Brown continues, "And it's so dark up there, I can't find it."
I bet he wrote these on the same day. I mean, it's the same setup. The characters are positioned the same way. Patty on the left, him on the right. It sounds like a follow-up to him being... I mean, it's a joke, but I don't think he's joking in this one.
I think you're right. Yeah, this is more of the classic, you know, they're just looking at each other deadpan as if they're not aware of the humor.
Yeah, and the way he develops in panel four, that classic profile of Patty where you don't see any indication of the mouth, which is the most deadpan. It almost looks like one of those pop figures or something like that. And he'll use that again and again. And I don't remember many cartoon. I mean, maybe there are some examples where, but, you know, the whole mouth would disappear on a profile.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of like Thimble Theater and Popeye.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to go back and look and see if that was something. I know Schultz totally loved that strip. And what about
Huge?
Same deal? Were there shots of them profiles where the mouth just isn't present?
In which one?
Crazy Cat?
Yeah, probably. Yes, I can see. Yeah, I can see that. But it's different because they're all animals, so it's a different effect, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it does say, "Are you crazy?" I mean, it's just like total disbelief that somebody said that.
Yeah,
I don't know why not having a mouth would mean that, but it sort of says that.
Yeah, it's.
Is that the way you read Patty there? That she's just like.
Yeah, she's like stunned that
stupefied.
He just said something so stupid.
Yeah, I always read it that way as well. February 2nd. Charlie Brown is walking with Snoopy. Charlie Brown looks annoyed. He says, "Go home, Snoopy, go home." Panel 2. He admonishes Snoopy further. "Go home, I say. Stop following me." Patty looks on questioning. Panel 3. Patty says to Charlie Brown, "He's not following you. He lives in that direction." Panel 4. Charlie Brown walks off, embarrassed, with Snoopy following him.
And Snoopy gets the joke because he's smiling.
He does.
Yeah, this is really important because clearly, I mean, this is clearly saying he's not Charlie Brown's dog.
Right.
Right.
And it doesn't seem to be Patty's dog either.
Schultz doesn't seem to know whose dog it is at this point.
Yeah, he feels at best like a neighborhood dog.
Mm-hmm. Little collar, and he's obviously doing well for himself.
Yeah.
Whoever owns him.
February 7th. A new character enters the world. A little girl with pigtails. And she is looking at Snoopy and Charlie Brown, and she says to Snoopy, "Well, hello there." In panel 2, she kneels down to talk to Snoopy eye to eye and says, "You don't know me, do you? My name is Violet." Charlie Brown, "Ahem." "You're real cute," continues Violet, speaking to Snoopy. "Ahem," says Charlie Brown. Panel 4, it's just Charlie Brown and Snoopy. And Charlie Brown looks at Snoopy and says, "Well, why didn't you introduce me?" And Snoopy has two hearts above his head.
This is a real important strip. It's the appearance of a new cast member. This is Violet, and I consider myself a Violetologist. I am incredibly interested in this character who changes pretty radically. But you'll see that even though Charlie Brown and Patty are friends, they're around each other a lot, but you don't see much affection. Mostly he's saying something, some wisecrack to get her angry, or she's slugging him or something. But, you know, as far as four-year-olds go, this is like a romance. You know, it doesn't last long into the strip. But I was really interested when last episode Harold mentioned that he just got married. And I really think Violet is a representation of his wife. You know, this one is just a little bit of jealousy. Because, you know, but she's not paying any attention to him, but to Snoopy. But we'll see. We'll as this goes, you'll see that she is really sweet, as opposed to Patty, who's kind of a nightmare.
So he probably drew this, what, maybe 5 months before the marriage?
Uh-huh.
They could be engaged. We don't exactly know. We know it was a pretty quick romance simply because of what we know about the daughter Meredith. But, I agree. I mean, I like this on a lot of levels. It, obviously, new character is always interesting and fascinating. But, you know, what you were talking about earlier, Michael, about the nature of Charlie Brown and Snoopy, where, you know, Charlie Brown in that previous strip just a month earlier is glad the dogs can't read. And yet we're, the punchline here is that Charlie Brown expects the dog to introduce him. So the nature of what's expected of an animal is starting to shift a little bit here, where even the kids are now thinking that the dog capable of more than you'd expect the dog to be. Of course, it's also a very, I think, a very kid thing to say too. I mean, you could just say it's a funny joke, but it, Charlie Brown is expecting it.
Yeah, I don't think this strip works as a joke. It's certainly not logical, you know, considering what he's developed so far. No, I think it's important just because this Violet character is, you know, being a new character and also a very important character in the first few years.
I like the strip because it there's just a lot going on. You know, you got, again, the introduction of the character. You've got this little cute relationship between Violet and Snoopy. You've got Charlie Brown, who's trying to horn his way into it. You got Snoopy's little reverie of being in love with Violet and Charlie Brown being ticked off with Snoopy. I mean, for a four-panel strip, that's about as sophisticated as anything I've seen so far.
That is a lot to get in there. What do we think of Violet's character design?
I like the pigtail Violet. The ponytail Violet is evil, so she changes fast.
Yeah, I love the design of her. I think she's very cute. I'm not a huge fan of the experimentation he's doing with filling in the blacks, because he's drawing so much attention to his ink lines, which he usually doesn't do. And to me, it's distracting.
Yeah, and it feels a little bit throwbacky. It doesn't feel as modern as, say, you know, the Patty character design, which is, you know, just these flowing outlines, you know, going in there with that brush. And it's not the most facile brush inking. I agree. It does sort of stand out as not being quite of the world with the wet rest.
Do you think that's a brush, or do you think that's a really flexible pen?
It could be a really flexible pen. I mean, he's definitely, I don't think at this point, using that radio pen nib that he uses from like the late 50s onward. I think it's probably one of those gelat nibs, which are super flexible, if anything. But I also, yeah, I mean, I think there's a good chance it's a brush. I could be wrong though. February 15th. Charlie Brown is in the bath. He tosses a rubber ducky out, saying, "Ducks." In panel 2, he tosses a toy boat out, says, "Boats." In panel 3, he tosses out, I guess, a rubber swan and yells, "Swans." In panel 4, he looks at us and says, "Great Scott, can't a man take a bath with any privacy?"
Funny. I think using the word "man" is what makes it funny.
You could too.
Yeah.
I really, this one just makes me laugh. This is one of my nominees, and it's nice design on Charlie Brown. For some reason, on the second panel, we don't see the full completion of the line on Charlie Brown's head, and he's not wearing a shirt. You have an open head, which I actually find really, really nicely done. And there's some these little tiny things where he's throwing his arm back. You see a little line for the inside of the armpit. That, I mean, it's just beautiful, beautiful design. It's some of my favorite drawing of Charlie Brown in this year.
It has a solidity and an observed quality that the more iconic ones don't.
Yeah.
And that could definitely be the result of having a little baby that you're giving baths to. Not the joke, not the words, but the observation of what a kid in a tub looks like.
Okay, what could be?
February 24th. Violet is sitting outside. In front of her is a piece of wood containing 3 mud pies. She says, "These are very special mud pies. I've sprinkled them with coconut." In panel 2, she presents one to Charlie Brown, who smiles. Violet says, "Here, Charlie Brown, have a mud pie. Pardon my fingers." In panel 3, Charlie Brown tastes it and does not seem pleased. Violet looks concerned. Charlie Brown says, "Phooey,
This tastes awful. He drops the mud pie on the ground. Violet looks at it sadly. Charlie Brown says, I'm sorry, Violet, but I just don't like coconut.
Good joke. I think this is an attempt to give Violet a shtick, an ongoing shtick. Since the characters are still a little two-dimensional or very two-dimensional, occasionally he will come up with a character that has one quality and play it over and over again. And a lot of these characters never evolve. I mean, I'm thinking mostly of like Pigpen, who, you know, the jokes are he's dirty. And Schultz relied on this mud pie thing all year for Violet and then abandoned it. But, you know, it gave her, you know, I guess it makes it a lot easier to come up with gags if you have sort of a recipe for creating them.
Well, and I think it goes back again to talking about his Crazy Cat influence, where he was looking for his scenarios that he could just, you know, wring comedy out again and again and again, just with subtle variations on the theme. And ultimately, actually, he does come up with a list of things he calls his 12 devices, which are the 12 things he believes that made Peanuts a success. And most of them are things like this, little scenarios that he would come back to again and again and again. Not, you know, even more famous than the mud pies, but things like the football or the psychiatry booth. And I think that's what he's doing. I think he's trying to find those little things that he can go back to again and again and just wring new humor out of. And because mud pies actually last past this year, I believe. I'm certain it lasts past this year.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, to your point that maybe Violet comes into the strip because of this new relationship with Joyce. This is a very sympathetic through line. This is the four little panels with Violet. She seems to be very intent with what she's doing. She's doing it with care. It's done in a kind of a three-quarters view on that first panel, but he's using that profile nose and mouth so that it's very, again, kind of UPA-y in the idea, or Picasso-like, in that one part of the body is facing one direction and the other part is facing another, which is kind of a good intrication that he's still experimenting a lot with design and what he's comfortable with and what he likes. But Violet herself is all the way through, is just, she seems to be a good character in this strip. You just see in these simple little drawings that she's got a heart to her.
As a small note, this also establishes Charlie Brown's long-running hatred of coconut.
Right.
He constantly, over the years, goes back to referring that he does not like coconut.
I'm glad he was consistent.
Yeah, and Snoopy doesn't like coconut either.
Is there anyone who does?
I don't know. Well, I guess Violet. March 28th. Violet is skipping rope. She's counting. 11-6. 30-12, she skips more rope and counts some more. 54, 40-60, 1-teen, Shermie runs up. Hey, Violet! Violet looks annoyed as she stops jumping. Now look what you've done. You made me lose count.
Well, it's very funny because that's a little kid thing. I mean, making up, not really knowing numbers.
Is it?
Yeah.
I think it seems like something someone who has no knowledge of children thinks is a little kid thing. Like, a kid doesn't go 11-12. I really don't think so. That's what I mean. I think when he does the kiddy kid stuff, it never rings true to me.
Hmm. Yeah. I can see that. This one, I think it's a clever joke on Pulse's part, but it's, yeah, it doesn't ring true as a kid to me.
Yeah, and I think once he starts putting his own thoughts and his own, you know, insecurities and loves and stuff in the character's mouths, instead of trying to imagine what a kid must be like, it starts working, because a kid is much more like an adult brain. They just don't have the language. And he gives the kids the language, which is what the magic peanuts is. You know, once a kid counts,
you know, reading it as kids, I think that's when it really does strike us that he's in my mind. You know, this is the way I think. Even as a 7-year-old, I have memories of sophistication of thought seemed more real to me in what I was seeing in these strips than what I was seeing anywhere else.
Right. No, I agree. I feel the same way about it.
So sorry to veto you there, Michael. It is a funny joke. I think.
Well, I don't have kids, so I don't know.
April 18th. Violet is pursuing Charlie Brown. She looks annoyed. Violet says, "Charlie Brown, you said that I was your girl." She continues to talk at him angrily. "And yet I saw you down at the drugstore today with Patty." Panel 3. Charlie Brown throws his hands out wide and says, "All right, I admit it." As he walks away, he says, "I'm not above that sort of thing."
It's great. Yeah, I should have picked that one.
The odd thing to point out here is this is the strip that ran the day of their wedding. You know, now they're married on a Wednesday, so I can't exactly know him working 6-8 weeks in advance if he knew this would have fallen on that day. He knew it was going to happen. He probably would have chosen another strip.
It's great.
It is a really funny joke. And then Charlie Brown walking away with his hands in his pockets, all devil mink hair. April 26th. Patty and Violet are walking down the street. Violet says, "Boys are rough and mean, aren't they?" Patty and Violet continue to walk. Patty says, "I'll say they are, but girls are different. Girls are kind and gentle." They come upon Charlie Brown and scream at him, "Get out of the way!" They pass and continue talking. Violet says, "Girls are peace-loving and considerate."
On and on. I think this is important in the development of these characters. And keep in mind that we're skipping a lot. You know, we're just jumping a few every month. There have been a lot of strips with Violet being really sweet and, you know, making the mud pies and giving them to people. And she just seems to be really kind-hearted. Here we see a phenomenon where that he really builds on, which is whenever Violet is with Patty, she starts acting like Patty and becomes really mean. Whenever they're together, and you'll see a lot of these, and this is the first one where I can't imagine Violet doing this just walking by herself. But when she's with Patty, she takes on Patty's characteristics, which is really typical of kids. You know, if you're with somebody, they do something bad, you do something bad. Just and seeing Charlie Brown,
but that's a subtlety of character. That's a subtlety of characterization you're not getting in most strips at this time. That I mean, like you say, usually it's they attach one personality trait, yeah, and that's what that person is.
This is getting more sophisticated. And it's also showing Charlie Brown as the victim of these two girls, which, I mean, that's a running theme, basically, is they're the ones, usually the boys are kind of nice to him. Shermie's always nice to him, and Linus is nice to him. It's usually the girls who try to get his goat. And especially when Lucy comes along, she kind of replaces Patty and Violet in just sheer nastiness.
I mean, Charlie Brown is sweating. He is sweating in this last panel after they left him. He's been shaken up here. This is not he doesn't just brush that one off.
Well, and as you see, even in panel 3, the way he looks shocked, he looks not just shocked that there's a loud noise. He looks shocked that these people are saying this to him.
Yeah, why would they say such a thing?
Yeah, what is going on here all of a sudden?
No, one thing that is, I wonder why Schultz made this choice. You have this conversation between Violet and Patty, but it's Violet who introduces the idea that boys are rough and mean. Now, we haven't seen anybody treat Violet rough and mean, have we, in the strips?
No.
So I would have thought maybe Patty would have been the one who would have planted the seed, and then Violet would kind of go along with it, but it's the other way around.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, actually. Yeah, you know, I think he wasn't at that level of understanding of the characters yet, you know? So he was at this point probably, you know, if he would have maybe even had more time or whatever, he would have put a little more thought into it and switched those
speaking parts around, but I think he would just like make the joke work.
Yeah, and he's looking at it from a different angle. I think he's trying to find the humor and the, obviously, the dichotomy between those who say they're sweet. And...
right. Yeah, that's his focus.
Yeah, it does feel like classic Peanuts just a few months in.
For sure. May 7th, Shermie, Charlie Brown, and Patty are sitting putting together a jigsaw puzzle. Panel 2, Charlie Brown gets up and stretches, saying, "Well, I hate to break up the game, but I guess I'll have to be going." Panel 3, he continues to talk. Shermie and Patty make no reaction in his direction. They continue to put together the puzzle. Charlie Brown says, "I said I hate to break up the game, but I guess I'll have to be going." And he walks out of the house in his jaunty hat and says, "Rats."
This is classic.
First off, I love a good jaunty hat.
This is classic Charlie Brown. I mean, this could have been done years later, this exact same strip.
Yeah,
it totally defines his personality. He's like nobody. He's a nowhere man. And that rats thing is, I don't know if that's the first time he says rats, but basically that's his word for when something really humiliating happens to him.
That is pretty classy.
Is rats something that was just a slang term that was around? Oh. Do people say that?
Oh, rats. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it existed in comics. I don't know who was using it right now.
I said it many a time.
May 30th, Charlie Brown is playing in a sandbox. Patty approaches him and says, "Have you met Schroeder yet, Charlie Brown?" They walk off together. Charlie Brown asks, "Schroeder, who's he?" Patty answers, "He lives next door. Come on, I'll introduce you." Patty introduces Charlie Brown to a smiling baby boy in a onesie. She says, "Here he is. Say something to him." Charlie Brown says, "I don't know what to say." In panel 4, he continues, "I always feel so uncomfortable near children." First appearance of Schroeder.
Important. Sound the trumpets.
No indication of Beethoven yet, but it is the first instance of someone arriving as a baby, which happens again and again as the years go on in Peanuts.
He must have considered it as quite the success to revisit it in later years.
It is a really odd way to go about it, to have your new characters introduced as like a new generation as a baby, and then they grow up in age to the point where they become Charlie Brown's age, and then everybody freezes.
That's the Schultzian rule, right? It's moving forward at its own pace.
But Charlie Brown is still noticeably smaller than Patty and still younger, but he's now been replaced as the little kid in the group.
And I wonder if part of that is from, like, when we saw that earlier strip of Charlie Brown sitting there crying, he's just clearly too old a character for that type of behavior. Mm-hmm. So maybe Schultz is getting inspiration from the baby in his house, his new little daughter, and he needs a place to put that. At least maybe that's his initial thoughts.
Yeah.
I would think that there's definitely something to that. It's a huge part of his life. And he's initially working out of the house. Now they probably don't move in being, the mores of the 50s. He's not moved in until the 18th, which would have been really just maybe what we're about 4-6 weeks when he drew this before he actually has moved in, but he's obviously around them a lot. But the interesting thing is he works out of the home very briefly. They don't have a lot of money, moved to this new town. And the one thing that Charles Schultz did put his foot down about, he often said he was wishy-washy, but when it came to working from home, he said, "This is not working." And he got himself an office very quickly in downtown Colorado. That's a very interesting telling thing about, you know, where Schultz's priorities were. You know, they didn't have a lot of funds to mess with at this point, but that was a super priority for Schultz to be able to work in privacy.
Now, I had heard that
I believe I read somewhere that it was his mother-in-law that suggested it.
Yes, that is, I think that's true. I think, I think he got a little bit of support for it, but I'm sure it was not an expense that they were happy to have at the time.
Oh, no, especially when, you know, he's able to really do it as he has been on the card table in the basement.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would like to point out something here, and I have a feeling I may know where an inspiration for Schroeder comes from. I've never heard anyone say this before. Maybe it's been said a lot, but I have a theory.
This is exciting. This could be an Unpacking Peanuts exclusive. All right, lay it on us.
Okay. So we were talking about UPA before, Jim, right?
Yes.
Well, in 1950, UPA puts out on November 2nd a very, very influential cartoon into movie theaters called Gerald
McBoing Boing Boing. Oh, my Lord.
And Gerald McBoing Boing is this little kind of toe-headed kid who's got a kind of a sweet disposition, but is, instead of being able to speak normal words, once he gets to the age of speaking, he makes sound effects. So like of a train, freight train or a bouncing sound, which is where the McBoing Boing comes from. It was an idea by Dr. Seuss. It made a huge impact because it was very stylized in its artwork, very simplified, very large heads for the little child, in the same kind of proportions that we see here. I'm not saying that Schultz was following UPA style to start, but he found something that was very simpatico with what he was doing when he saw or heard of Gerald McBoing Boing. I'm almost sure he heard about Gerald McBoing Boing, given the fact that that would have been when he was in St. Paul at the Art Instruction School. People were talking about this. It wins the Academy Award on March 29th, 1951, about 8 or 9 weeks before this strip comes out. I'm guessing Schultz saw still frames in newspapers and magazines about this remarkable cartoon, which was super stylized. And when I see it later, and I'll point it out in a later strip, but the little tuft of hair that you see here with Schroeder and this three quarters view in this strip isn't quite as strong. But the thing that brought me to this was a later strip when I saw something that I didn't see in some of the other strips, where it's a profile of Schroeder playing the big piano.
Right.
The angle on the piano is not entirely in line with the perspective of Schroeder. And when you see him in profile, he gets that little curly Q line from the top of his head. It's down to the forehead that kind of creates the hair for Schroeder as this little baby version, which is very similar to Gerald McBoing Boing.
Yeah, and I believe you're talking about October 2nd, which we will talk about in depth later. But yeah, I can, the panel 3 and October 2nd, I completely see what you're saying.
And I'll throw one other thing in here that I think is fascinating. And that's the, you know who the lead animator was?
On Melendez?
Bill Melendez.
Wow.
Went on to do the animated series for Schultz throughout his career. So, and there's actually, I just watched the Gerald McBoing Boing thing earlier today. And there's one shot that is totally Charlie Brown Christmas that I'd never seen before or since, and it's in both cartoons. I'm betting you anything Melendez drew it. It's a shot of little Gerald McBoing, super long shot, high angle, with lots of Picasso-esque angles, him going off to the schoolhouse for the first time. And you just see this little dot hopping around, and it just kind of bops up and down.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Charlie Brown does at the end of the Charlie Brown Christmas, when he gets the little Christmas tree and decides he's going to take it home.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, you know what? I would not be surprised if you're onto something there.
Yeah, I mean, because he doesn't speak, right? And neither does Gerald McBoing Boing. And in this case, it's he's into music at a very, very sophisticated instead of sound effects. And this doesn't take anything away from Schroeder at all for me to say that. I think it may have been a little bit of a nudge for Schroeder to think up something new and fresh.
Yeah, for sure. And even though Schroeder does not have much of a depth to his personality, he becomes one of the things that really is most identified with Peanuts, I think.
Yeah. it is remarkable how single-minded a character can be and embraced at the same
time. Yeah, but he where would Schroeder be without Lucy? I mean, that the gags were Lucy, Schroeder was the object.
Yeah.
Interesting to follow up until the point when Lucy really does start to take on that role. Is Schroeder just staying pigpen until Lucy shows up?
Right. June 26th. Charlie Brown answers the door. Patty is there waiting for him. Charlie Brown says, "I think I'll stay in this afternoon, Patty." They both sit on the step, talking to each other. Charlie Brown says, "I'm going to read to Grandma." Patty answers, "Read? You know you can't read." Charlie Brown stands up and says, "That doesn't matter." As he heads back inside, he says, "Grandma can't hear either."
This is a case where he sacrifices all logic for the joke. And I think this is one of the best jokes of the year. But we know he can read because he can write. He's writing in his diary.
Right. Yeah, he is just searching for gags.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. July 3rd. Two characters are walking by with what looks like sheets pulled over their heads, pretending they're ghosts. One is clearly a dog. Panel 2, the human under the sheet says to Patty, "Boo." Then the dog under the sheet also says to Patty, "Boo." They continue walking, and Patty looks at us, confused.
Important, mainly because one of the few times Snoopy actually says something out loud. But I think maybe he does another boo joke later in the year, but that doesn't come back. Snoopy never talks.
Well, boo is a great word for him to use, though, because it's also could, you know, theoretically be a sound a dog could make.
Yeah. But I think what's more important here is the reaction shot, which, I mean, becomes one of Schultz's main tools for pacing. Is the joke is not in the last panel.
Right.
The last panel is people reacting to the joke. And I don't know if this is the first time he does it, but this is a real trademark of the strip.
And just a huge innovation, I think, in the way, you know, comic strip jokes are told.
Yeah, also for the record, looks like Snoopy speaks before Schroeder does. And
I think these drawings look like late period. You know, because we're familiar with the ghosts from things like Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown or whatever, but it does not have the really slick, you know, 50s inking that the other strips have. For some reason, those characters feel like they came out of like the late 60s, early 70s. August 24th, Charlie Brown is on the pitcher's mound. He throws one in. Snoopy is standing behind them. In the fourth panel, Snoopy raises an ear, and Charlie Brown argues with him, saying, "A ball? What do you mean? That was right over the plate."
You got to explain this to our foreign fans.
Or should you explain what baseball is?
Well, they would not, understand this at all. Because he's raising, Snoopy's the umpire, and the umpire would raise his hand on a ball, and Snoopy raises one ear.
Yeah, well, it's also really Sandlot rules, where the umpire stands behind the pitcher in real baseball that you would watch in, you know, Major League Baseball or high school baseball even or whatever. You know, yeah. 9 times out of 10, the umpire is behind the plate. Occasionally in a school game, they will stand behind the.
Yeah, but the important thing about this strip is, I mean, it's a real significance is first pitch for Charlie Brown.
And it's a ball.
And it's a ball.
And further development of Snoopy, because Snoopy is sophisticated enough to be able to be an umpire.
Yeah.
If not a player yet in the team.
Mm-hmm. One thing I really love in this is in the fourth panel, we see something we normally don't really see a lot of, as I recall. It's the inside of the mitt. Where the little cutout is, and you see Charlie Brown's tiny, tiny little hand.
Yes.
I never noticed that. That's really cute. I like the drawing in general in that strip. I think panel 2 of him winding up is really good too.
Yeah, I like Charlie Brown's expression in panel 4.
Yeah.
And I like the little jaunty curve of the cap in panels 1 and 3 that you don't, you know, basically the way Charlie Brown and all of the kids' baseball caps were drawn in later years is so abstract.
Yeah.
But this is a very well ventilated cap with lots of holes in it.
A baseball cap is something that's very hard to draw, actually. I think the abstraction, the only thing harder than a baseball cap to draw on someone's head, I think, is a fedora. Those are both really, really hard. You can always tell when Will Eisner wasn't drawing the spirit, because it didn't have to be another genius like Jack Cole, but they couldn't draw the hat. So props for Schultz for trying to draw a decent hat there.
Yeah.
August 16th. Violet is calling after Charlie Brown, who is walking away, scowling. Violet says, "I don't care what you call me, Charlie Brown." She continues, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names can never hurt me." In panel 3, she walks away. But in panel 4, she turns back and yells, "You blockhead!" And there you have it, folks.
Look, this is the first Lucy. I think this is Lucy. I mean, look at that panel 3, that scowl on her face.
Now, is this the first blockhead?
It might be the first blockhead, but everything in this is exactly what Lucy would do. And he might even have used this gag later on. No, this is, I mean, it's Violet, and it's, he's changing her personality. I mean, this is not a sweet person. This is a mean person.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the sweet Violet does have a lot of appeal, but in a medium where you're trying to write a joke every single day, she's a character that doesn't have a lot of grit, a lot of things that can cause an agitation to get to the joke. So clearly he's trying something different. And it does feel like, yeah, I mean, that feels like you could transplant that again into 1965 with Lucy and it would work.
I think what's the thing interesting here to see in this particular strip is, again, we're, you know, not to read too much into this, but, you know, we're a couple months into this new relationship of the marriage and having to live with somebody, you know, full time. This is a big deal when you get married. And what I really find interesting in this strip is that these characters are equals. You know, later years, Charlie Brown seems kind of put upon. They got one up on him. Looks like Charlie Brown started something here. He called Violet something in panel 1, and he's not happy. Neither of them are. And she's standing up to him. And, you know, there's no good guy or bad guy here. There's nobody here we're supposed to feel.
Yeah, that's true, because we don't know what Charlie Brown said to her. And if anybody is the bad guy, you could imply that it's Charlie Brown because he said something to her.
Right. Yeah, he may have been the first one who started it, but
I should say,
strong character this year. He really is, and this is an interesting example of where he's toe to toe with these other characters, and Schultz is not asking for any sympathy or for us to see him as put upon in this case.
September 24th, Charlie Brown presents Schroeder with a toy piano. Charlie Brown says, "See how easy it is, Schroeder?" as he taps at the keys. Plink, plink, plink. He continues plinking away at the piano. Charlie Brown says, "The piano is a beautiful instrument if played properly." Plink, plink, plink. In panel 3, he presents the piano to Schroeder and says, "Now let's hear you play, huh, Schroeder?" Panel 4, Charlie Brown is embarrassed as a font of beautiful music pours forth from Schroeder's piano. So there we go. We see the first appearance of Schroeder as a musical prodigy and his first appearance of his striped shirt.
Yeah.
And is this the first time we've seen that really fancy transcribed treble and bass clef notation that Schultz was so proud of?
I'm sure it is.
Yeah, I mean, we have some earlier strips with Charlie Brown playing the violin, but those are just, you know, some stray notes drawn here and there, you know, cracking and breaking. yeah, I think that's the first. I'm just looking through the book again. That definitely seems like the first instance of that. And yes, Schultz was very proud of this because this was not a photocopy or anything like that in 1950. He actually hand copied that score.
No.
Yes.
You can actually go in and play this and see what it is that he's.
It's not photoshopped.
Yeah.
Amazing.
No, I don't think it was Photoshop. I think Photoshop 2.0 was out then, but you know, Schultz probably wouldn't have had access to that till the mid 50s.
Okay.
You know, and one other thing I'd like to point out here, I believe this might be the strip that starts a sequence of gags in which we don't really see this year much at all. They're almost all one-offs, but I think he has like at least four strips in a row that feature this idea. This was like the gold mine that Schultz hit on in 1951, where he was like, I got ideas here.
Yeah, for sure. And it really does add, you know, the musical notation does add more of that sophistication to the strip. You know, it's a brilliant way to visually communicate music. I mean, you're working with a silent medium. There's never a sound in a comic strip. But, you know, we've already know that that's the way sophisticated music is notated. So seeing it there, it just works perfectly. You can almost hear it.
Aesthetically, it looks really nice compared to his characters. It just makes for a beautiful panel.
It does. And, you know, I'm looking at these with these panels that we have pulled out to discuss with you today. So I'm looking at them on one big sheet and seeing Violet right above that. She stands out to me as a character design from the past. The brush strokes or the flat pen strokes or whatever in her hair, it just does not feel anywhere near as smooth and sophisticated as the rest of it.
Yeah.
Okay, so Harold, this is what you were talking about earlier. October 2nd, panel 1, we have Schroeder at his toy piano playing some classical music. In panel 2, Charlie Brown walks up and leads Schroeder away by the hand and says, "Come on, Schroeder, we'll see how good you are on a real piano." Charlie Brown looks on, confused, as Schroeder just bursts into tears at the sight of the actual piano keys. Charlie Brown brings him back to his toy piano and says, "I don't get it, I just don't get it." And Schroeder is back at the piano playing beautiful music again as he slowly stops crying.
Yeah, this was that first panel in this strip is the thing that made me think UPA and which led me down the rabbit hole of lining up Gerald McBoing-Boing with Schroeder's debut. The first panel, Schultz, he's playing with some things that are really interesting. He has a shadow line that goes underneath Schroeder and goes through part of the piano, which probably doesn't make sense. You guys could probably tell me better than I would know, but it doesn't seem like that is in any way an actual shadow line that would exist in real life. You've got Schroeder, what looks like he's head on when it comes to the beautiful design of this profile head. And then you have feet that suggest, the shoes suggest that there's an angle at which he's sitting, but he's covering up the front of the feet of the back foot, which kind of is only now as high as the front. Anyway, it's got a lot of really odd things going on that create a little bit of that Picasso-esque UPA kind of perspective.
Yeah, there is something about cartooning in general that's lightly cubist. And when something is framed too much like a photo, it feels less lively because there's almost an implied movement within the one image. You know, if you have various little perspectives and various little things that are sort of off from one another, it gives the thing a bounce and a life to it. You know, like obviously the piano is at a completely different angle than the kid, but you know, it's like a Cezanne painting or something like that. It just works as a design. And I think I think this is a beautifully drawn strip. And I think the beautifully drawn keyboard in panel 3 is nicely offset by the notes and the notation that he does in the other panels. It's really pretty.
Yeah, I agree. It's really nicely done. I wonder if there was a piano in the new home.
Oh, maybe, because that's definitely observed from something. October 4th, Charlie Brown comes upon a fence. Written on the fence is Charlie Brown loves Patty. Charlie Brown takes something out of his pocket and he crosses out Charlie Brown loves Patty. Then we see him walking away, having replaced the graffiti with Charlie Brown loves the whole wide world.
This is such an interesting strip for this time of Peanuts. I don't know if that this strip would have existed any other year. I could be wrong about that, or maybe it would just have a slightly different angle on it. But it's funny, you know, someone other than Charlie Brown has written on a fence that Charlie Brown loves Patty. And it's interesting that it's Patty and not Violet, too. So does that suggest that he sees something and says, well, that's not true, but he's going to replace it with something else? It's just, there's so many odd things about this script. So Charlie Brown looks like he's on top of things in the second panel. He's got the classic tongue sticking out when you're thinking. I don't know if that's happened before in this strip or if this is the first time we see that. It must have existed somewhere before, but he's reaching into his pocket. And interestingly, so he crosses out Charlie Brown's Patty on a really nicely angled fence that makes me think of like Napoleon, the old strip with the big fluffy dog. And then when he walks away, he's written apparently a new version, Charlie Brown loves the whole wide world. But did he write that fresh? He's got the same lettering as whoever wrote the first thing. There's a lot of oddballs about this, but the idea that that's how Charlie Brown sees Charlie Brown and he gets away with it, right? He has the final say, and there's no irony. It's just an unusual, odd, unique strip. And I'm just fascinated about Charles Schulz in this time period. It seems like it's this little window of confidence that he's working in.
November 14, Violet is holding a football. She looks very nervous and says, "He'll kick my hand. I just know he will." In panel 2, Charlie Brown comes running up to kick the football. But Violet says, "I can't go through with it," as she lets go of the football. In panel 3, Charlie Brown, with a huge question mark over his head, kicks at the ball, misses the ball, and lands flat on his back. In panel 4, he is lying there, stars above his head, as Violet says, "You didn't kick the ball, Charlie Brown. Why didn't you kick it?"
Who does this remind you of? I think he was starting to come up with these great gags and realize he didn't have the right character for them. I mean, she's still, she's not being mean at all. She's just scared. And I think he saw that third panel. He went, "This is funny. We've got to find another situation for this."
And the crazy cat thing again, this is one of the great themes that he will milk for, I was shocked reading this, that it predates Lucy.
Yeah, it's stunning. But that's two Violet doing Lucy shticks.
Yeah, and it's probably the worst drawn Charlie Brown on the fourth panel of the whole year. He didn't quite know how to do that. But
Well, that's a really, that almost looks like a Dan Klaus drawing. It's really hard to draw a figure laying down at all. And at that angle, it's hard. And Charlie Brown's already in weird proportions. That just looks strange.
Well, he's lifting his head up. He's not flat on the ground.
And that's interesting. I mean, I don't know why Schulz felt he needed to show that belabored expression.
Yeah, it would be better if it was undersold.
I mean, I think of the classic thing when you just see the pants and the legs when they're and they're just hanging there. And this one, yeah. The funny thing is you don't see the face. Schulz became a master of those types of things.
Absolutely. November 23rd, Patty and Violet confront Charlie Brown. Violet says, "We're going to have a party, Charlie Brown, but we're not going to invite you." Charlie Brown walks away saying, "What do I care? I don't want to go to your old party anyway." Patty sits down on the curb saying, "I wonder if he really meant that." Violet says, I think he did. Patty says to Violet, well, in that case, maybe we'd better invite him.
This is so good. He's used this situation a lot with those two girls trying to get his goat and really being frustrated that he doesn't care.
Yeah. And it's also, again, this subtlety of personality, you know, where we see the, you know, the bullies and their own insecurities going, oh, gee, if he doesn't want to be here, maybe we do need to have him here.
Yeah.
That's a really nice observation about just humans, not just kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just think all the stories, Schultz always feeling like he was the one nobody wanted. And, you know, this is an observation from somebody who's spent a lot of time thinking about these things.
Yeah. Well, and it's like almost like a Buddhist thing, like the Zen, you know, the way to get what you want is to give up wanting it. Hmm. And that's exactly, you know, what Charlie Brown does. Fine. And you don't want to have me, I won't go. And then he gets his invitation.
That's great.
November 30th. Patty and Violet are sitting on the steps outside one of their houses. Patty says, I guess we really shouldn't talk this way about Charlie Brown. She continues, after all, he's a pretty good guy. Violet says, sure he is. Patty says, good old Charlie Brown. In panel 4, Patty says, however. Violet answers, yes. That's a really cute strip. I like that one a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, totally character driven. I mean, it's not really a joke there, but it's all sold with these characters.
Yeah. Yeah, you're living with these characters now. They really are starting to come to life, and this is my nomination for 1951. You know, Charlie Brown, after all, he's a pretty good guy. That's what the year is all about.
Yeah, it is. And you know what? I really like the drawing in this strip, too. I especially like panel 2, Violet kind of leaning back against the steps. Again, it looks like something that's observed, but, you know, to the degree, some degree, panel 1 as well. Eventually, he really codifies the drawing into a series of poses that work really well. And they become almost hieroglyphics. But these early things where he's still experimenting a little bit has some nice stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that panel 2 is lovely.
All right, guys. So that's Peanuts 1951. How about we let's sum up now that we've gone through these strips. Where do you think we've come over the course of these 365 days, Michael?
Well, I think it's mostly character development. It seems like later in the year, Charlie Brown is less of a wise guy. I mean, that was sort of his thing in 1950, was making wisecracks and getting people mad. He's a little bit more of a victim. We've got Patty and Violet as being sort of a team now who are against him in some ways. We've got the potential for some major character stuff out of Schroeder. And we've got Snoopy acting a little more human. So, I mean, it's you don't see the turning points particularly, but it's definitely the later strips, I think, are better. And Harold picked the last one here. And the one right before that was my pick for strip of the year with the party invitation. So I think it ends really strong. Looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, me too. And my pick for the year is going to be the first appearance of Schroeder playing the piano. Not because it's particularly funny or anything like that, but just because it's such a great moment in the history of Peanuts. And also, I remember that's one of the first strips I remember having a reprint of. One of the earliest strips, rather, I remember having a reprint of. So that's always been a kind of in my brain.
Well, those are both great strips. If I had to pick one, I would have to pick the introduction of Violet, simply because it's got three of the major characters in there, and it's so darn cute with Snoopy, and it's just showing personality on all three levels of these early versions of the characters that plays off nicely as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, and if you're out there listening and you want to get in on this conversation, why don't you follow us on our various social media feeds? You can find us on both Instagram and Twitter at Unpack Peanuts. And when you're there, you'll be able to vote who has the strip of the year. Is it my choice, Michael's choice, or Harold's choice? And of course, in all the comments, you can pitch out your own ideas. All right, guys. Well, this has been a real pleasure going through this year with you. I'm looking forward to doing 1952 next. So let's just say goodbye and until next time.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Thanks so much.
Bye, everybody. Be good.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening, you blockhead.